You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about some citizen science projects taking place across the state this spring and how you can get involved. First, public hearings on the next state budget are taking place this month. The first one was Friday in Janesville, the next one tomorrow in Oak Creek. There are two more scheduled for River Falls and Green Bay. Among the items being discussed include Governor Evers' plan to accept federal money to expand Medicaid. With that money, Evers plans to increase funding to hospitals, mental health services, long-term care, and other programs. But state Republican leaders say they're opposed to expanding Medicaid and plan on introducing their own budget. Andrea Palm is the Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Secretary Designee Palm, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Wisconsin, one of the 14 states to not accept this federal Medicaid money. Make the case for why you see a need to do this.
So our Medicaid expansion here in Wisconsin would allow us to cover an additional 82,000 adults and parents and save the state of Wisconsin $324.5 million. And that savings comes from our ability to draw down an enhanced match from the federal government. And that match is in the tune of about $1 billion. And then what we do with our savings and this new federal money is reinvested in the healthcare system to improve the system for everybody in Wisconsin, not just folks who receive services through the Medicaid program. And in doing so, we are allowed to bring a grand total of $1.6 billion in new federal money to the state of Wisconsin, again, to make really important investments in access to services, which is something that we've heard from Wisconsinites across this state.
Let's break down each half of that equation. First of all, when it comes to that expanded coverage you mentioned, who would that be covering? What income levels, what kind of people would find coverage under that?
Yep. So we would expand coverage from 100% of the poverty level to 138% of the poverty level. As I mentioned, it's about 82,000 people. It's a combination of childless adults, so single adults, as well as parents of children, but any adults between 100 and 138% of poverty would now be eligible.
Then you mentioned investments with some of the savings there for health services around the state. What kind of things specifically are you looking at?
Mm-hmm. So our budget tried to take the recommendations and the concerns that we were hearing from citizens around the state as it relates to gaps in the healthcare system. We know that folks have trouble accessing dental care, behavioral health care, including psychiatrists. We know that our long-term care system needs to be ready not just now to serve children and adults with disabilities and our aging citizens, but also needs to be ready as we all age and as our workforce ages to be ready to handle a population that's going to need long-term care services out into the future. So our investments range from increases in reimbursement rates so that we can reduce workforce shortages, recruit and retain more professionals in these various spaces so people can access care more easily because providers want to serve the Medicaid population and others, as well as increased services around the long-term care system and in the behavioral health system so people can actually access needed services in their local communities.
Yesterday on the show, we talked about a new Wisconsin Public Television documentary on healthcare gaps in rural Wisconsin in particular, where people might live very far away, say, from a specialist that they might need to see. Is that something you would work on with this budget?
Mm-hmm. So I think what we know about rural communities particularly is that the healthcare infrastructure that they have really is often the cornerstone of their communities. It's the largest employer. It's a critical component of their economic development. And so Medicaid expansion not only would allow us to support those key cornerstones of those economies, but would also be able to improve access to services through things like telehealth, which is also a part of our budget and something that we can afford with new investments from the Medicaid expansion. We think that opportunities to better access the providers we currently have through telehealth is an opportunity in rural areas to reduce barriers to care, reduce travel times, et cetera, and that, again, things like telehealth are critical components of our ability to do that. But we also think that our ability to invest this new federal money in rural healthcare also means that we'll be able to attract and retain more providers in those communities. The workforce shortages that they face as they try to serve their local communities are particularly acute. And so we think, again, we really need to make some investments with this new federal money and our ability to recruit and retain healthcare providers in local communities.
Talking to Andrea Palm, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, about the state budget and how it relates to Medicaid and health investments. Secretary Appointee Palm, Senate Republicans or state Republicans have been opposed to taking that federal Medicaid money in part in principle and also on a practical level. They're worried that it comes with so many question marks based on arguing in Congress over this that we might build a budget around it and then lose it all. What would you say to them?
I'd say a couple of things, Rob. I think first, the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land. It has been around for 9 years now. It has withstood all the way to the Supreme Court several challenges. And this idea that it's going away, I think, is a maybe just a good excuse for why not to take the money when it really is here to stay. I think the other thing we should consider is that the state of Wisconsin, unless there's something I don't know, pays federal taxes just like everybody else. And we've been sending our money from Wisconsin, hardworking Wisconsin citizens, for years and not pulling any of it back into the state, which we're entitled to through a Medicaid expansion. So our ability to draw down that $1.6 billion to make needed investments in the healthcare system that have, you know, been needed for a number of years now is a really important opportunity, and we should take it.
Supposing that the Republican legislature doesn't end up taking it, I mean, this is kind of the foundation of those healthcare investments that you talked about. What happens to this, the health part of the budget plan, without that Medicaid money?
So I think, Rob, without a Medicaid expansion and that $1.6 billion in new federal money, you would see status quo in the state of Wisconsin. The Department of Health Services would continue to do exactly what it's doing today, and you would see increasing fraying around the edges of our healthcare system, whether it's on the dental side, on the psychiatrist side, on some of the other access issues we're talking about, whether it's our ability to tackle our lead paint problem and reduce lead poisoning among kids, or some of the other investments that we would want to make, we just wouldn't be able to do it. And so you would see DHS treading water.
And finally, I've been referring to you as Secretary Designee. You've been appointed by Governor Evers. You're on the job, but not confirmed by the Senate. There was a confirmation hearing back in February. Now, today, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said none of the governor's cabinet appointees, including you, are going to be confirmed. This is a hang-up over a tiff over 15 appointments made in the lame duck session. What do you make of all this?
So I would say, Rob, that, I mean, it's an unbelievable honor to be nominated by Governor Evers to serve in his cabinet. I've worked hard since arriving here in Wisconsin to get to know the members of the Senate and to meet with them personally. Obviously, as you mentioned, I had a hearing. I'm anxious to get to work. We're working hard here at the department, and that's what I'll continue to do. I hope that the Senate sees clear to move the cabinet nominations. But in the meantime, I'm just going to keep my head down and keep working and continue to make the case to the people of Wisconsin about why a Medicaid expansion would not only benefit the 82,000 folks who would receive coverage under the expansion, but to all Wisconsinites as we are able to make investments in the system to improve it for everybody.
Secretary Designee Palm, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Andrea Palm, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We talked with her about Governor Evers' proposal to accept federal money to expand Medicaid as part of his 2-year budget. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This Saturday is Citizen Science Day. It's a national effort to get volunteers out in the field to assist and partner with professional scientists on a variety of projects. Here in Wisconsin, we're no strangers to citizen science. For over 100 years, volunteers have gotten involved in everything from monitoring water quality to counting birds and photographing dragonflies. This year is the 15th anniversary of the Wisconsin Citizen-Based Monitoring Network, which helps support these projects. Eva Lewandowski is a conservation biologist and the Citizen-Based Monitoring Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Eva, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Eva, sometimes I hear about citizen science, you know, people getting involved in science projects as this cool, newfangled thing. We've been doing this a long time in Wisconsin, right?
Absolutely. We have a very long and proud tradition of this partnership between members of the public and professional scientists. I think you mentioned, you know, over 100 years, going all the way back to the very first Christmas bird count in 1900, we have had these strong ties. So it's not a new idea for us at all.
Let's talk about what's in it for both sides of the equation. First of all, what do you see as the benefit for the citizens themselves, the everyday people who go out and take part in one form of citizen science or another?
Well, there's so many benefits. It's a great way to get outside, to experience nature, to see plants and animals and waters up close. It's a good way to meet people or to spend time with friends and family. And it's also a really great way to contribute to research, management, and conservation of our natural resources. And a lot of our volunteers are just incredibly passionate about protecting and understanding the land around them. So it offers so many different benefits.
And what do scientists get out of it? Do they get real research benefit from people getting out and getting involved?
We absolutely do. I mean, we would not be doing this if there wasn't a real benefit. It has incredibly powerful consequences for research, for management, for even for policy. We are only able to cover so much of the state with professional biologists. You know, there's only so many boots on the ground. And then when you start to bring in hundreds or thousands or even sometimes tens of thousands of volunteers, you are expanding that effort just dramatically. So we do get very high quality data, and we get data that covers the state and covers the years much more than we would be able to do on our own.
Now, somebody's out there thinking, oh, this sounds nice, but I didn't do so good in biology class. Maybe I'm not the person they want. Are they the person you want?
Well, we want everyone who wants to be involved. There are so many different projects in the state. The DNR alone runs over 20, and then there are many, many other projects. And what I like to tell people is that there's a project for everyone, every age, every background, every skill set. So, you know, if you're someone who doesn't know the first thing about identifying plants or how to take a water sample, you can probably spot a turtle crossing the road. And you can go online and report that to us. And then we have some volunteers who are, you know, expert biologists in their own right and can get more involved. So, again, projects for everyone, regardless of your skills or knowledge or expertise.
But I don't have to answer the question of why the turtle crossed the road. Is that right?
You don't have to. You can if you want to.
Well, now let's get to Citizen Science Day. It's this Saturday. There are a bunch of projects going on now, a bunch of ways to take part. And I want to actually talk about some of the specific ones. Let's start with the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey.
Sure.
Talk about that effort.
Right. Well, this is one of our longest-running projects. It's been running for over 35 years, and it's a project that requires people to know how to identify frogs and toads by call. So this is a project that you have to have a little bit of prior knowledge, or you have to teach yourself or learn. But there's two ways to get involved. You can do a traveling route where you stop at different points along a roadside, or you can pick one site. Maybe it's your house if you're lucky enough to live by a pond or a wetland, or maybe you go to a local park about once a week at night, and you listen for the frogs and toads that are calling. Write down what you're hearing and then tell us about them.
How many people usually get involved with this?
With the Frog and Toad Survey, it's usually over 100 throughout the state. So it's a popular project, but because there are, you know, you do need that little bit of advanced knowledge of knowing the calls, it's not something that every single individual would be interested in.
And do you ever get the results? Like, wait, hey, what's that kind of toad doing over here? We didn't expect to find them there.
Yeah, actually, we do. We've had some new county records or records that haven't been reported in several decades from our volunteers from the Frog and Toad Survey. And when that happens, oftentimes we'll send out a DNR biologist to just double check, or we'll ask if other volunteers are hearing something in the same area. So that's one of the big benefits, is that we'll get new records and learn more about the distribution and the range of the frogs and toads.
We're talking to Eva Lewandowski from the Wisconsin DNR, conservation biologist there. We're talking about citizen science, how everyday people can get involved in measuring, find out what's going on in nature around Wisconsin. Okay, Eva, another one. I couldn't tell the frog and toad calls apart. I can identify a crane, though. Tell us about the Midwest crane count.
Right. Well, the crane count is a great project, very popular, and it happens to be the same day as Citizen Science Day this year, so this Saturday, April 13th, so that makes it sort of doubly special. And it's a project that, this is a project that families can do together, that you don't need a lot of prior knowledge. You go out early in the morning on Saturday, and you listen for and you look for cranes. And like you said, most people, almost everybody in the state, can identify not just the crane by sight, but most people can identify that call overhead, right? You hear the sandhill crane and you know what it is. And so it's just a couple hours long. That's just the one day, one morning, all year round. So it's a quick and easy way to get started.
And before we look at some of the other projects, I should ask if people are thinking, yeah, I want to do that. How do we sign up?
So that is a project run through the International Crane Foundation. So you can either just Google that, or you can go to their website, which is savingcranes.org.
And if I wanted to do the Frog and Toad Survey, how do I sign up for that?
That you can find through the DNR website. And in fact, the DNR website links to almost all of our partner projects, like the annual Midwest Crane Count as well. So if you go to the DNR website, which is dnr.wi.gov, and just search for volunteer or search for citizen-based monitoring, you'll find all the information you need.
And then there's the Wisconsin, I've heard of this one, the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, well, that is a very exciting project. We are trying to document the distribution and abundance of all the bird species that breed in Wisconsin, and it's a five-year effort, and this is the final year of the project in 2019. So we are trying to finish strong and get people out throughout all the parts of the state that we haven't covered yet to find evidence of birds that are breeding. So that might be you see a bird building a nest, or you hear the male singing, or maybe you even see the nest with eggs, or you see the little baby fledglings. So it's that breeding evidence that's really important. And it can be anything from a robin that's breeding in your backyard, or you know, even on your porch, to someone who goes out into a really wet marsh and is looking for some of the secretive marsh birds, maybe some bitterns or some grebes or something like that. So all skill sets can help with that project.
All right, now here's one. I'll try to pronounce it. The Wisconsin Odonata Survey. Who are we looking for there?
That is a project that is primarily photography based. So if people are interested in photographing wildlife, that is the project for them. So odonates are our dragonflies and damselflies, which a lot of people just love to look at with their beautiful colors. So any place that you have water, whether it's a stream, a river, a little pond even, you can go out, you can photograph those beautiful dragonflies and damselflies, and you can learn to identify them, and we'll help you identify them as well. There's trainings and books and resources, and it's a project that you can start slow, you know, just take a couple pictures at first, but a lot of people find it very addictive, and quickly they find that's all they're doing all summer long.
So I was going to say, is there a peak season for this? But I feel like we see dragonflies from when it warms up till when it cools down.
Exactly. Yeah, the dragonflies can come out as early as end of March. I've seen a couple out here in April already, and they can last all the way through October.
Now, this is the National Citizen Science Day coming up on Saturday. I'm guessing from your perspective, every day can be Citizen Science Day. What
right.
kind of things can people do across the year to get involved?
Well, that's a great point. You know, this is a one-day event, the Citizen Science Day, but it's really just the start of this season. But there are projects that last all year round. There are projects even that go in winter. You can always look at birds in winter. There's up north carnivore tracking projects in winter. And then now, of course, into the spring, all the projects that we've talked about, plus lots of projects with pollinators, with turtles, with invasive species, native mussels, lake monitoring. The list just goes on and on and on. So it really is all year round. There are also a couple online projects if people are not interested in getting out and about outside and prefer to kind of sit at home. But it's something that you can do all year round. And again, you can just go to that DNR website and search for volunteer or search for citizen-based monitoring, and you'll find the list of all the projects that are available.
Do people get hooked? Do you have a lot of return customers doing citizen science?
We absolutely do. Yeah, people get hooked, and they get hooked on more than one project. So it's not at all unusual to meet someone who might be participating in 7 or 8 or even 10 or 12 different projects, and they'll say, oh, I started out with birds a decade ago, and now I do birds and turtles and frogs and toads and mussels and bumblebees and native plants and everything under the sun.
I imagine the temptation for you has got to be tough because there's so many you can choose from. Is there one you're going to be joining in on Saturday?
Well, I actually coordinate our bumblebee project, the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade, and it's a little early for bumblebees, but we did just receive today our very first bumblebee report of the season. So I am going to be keeping my eyes out for bumblebees this Saturday and see, but I'll probably see some birds for sure. You can always see birds, but I got my fingers crossed for the bumblebees.
Eva, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Eva Lewandowski, conservation biologist and the citizen-based monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, getting a taste of what's going on Citizen Science Day. That's coming up this Saturday. Again, you can check out the DNR website to find out what's going on around the state and how to sign up if you want to. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the psychology of hope and the role that hope plays in our mental and emotional well-being. It's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when you go to the store and buy somebody a card, does it seem like the selection isn't as big as it was a few years ago? There might be a reason for that. Industry experts say people aren't buying quite as many and stores aren't stocking up as much. In fact, CVS and Walmart recently said they plan to scale back on cards to make room for other stuff. But you know who still does buy cards? Millennials, apparently. So how are greeting card companies trying to appeal to them? Peter Doherty is the executive director of the Greeting Card Association. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rob. Appreciate it.
I've seen some different numbers about greeting card sales trends and how many we're selling. What do you see from where you're sitting?
Well, to start off, I have read the articles related to CVS and Walmart. I'm not privy to what's happening inside those companies, and I'm sure that they are quite healthy. And we're also not really able to get a handle on how the analysis of their products and space allocations take place. But, you know, the companies need to make decisions. They're seeing trends, especially in their local areas, and they need to make decisions and shifts as a result. This happens all the time. And I think there are many factors that might cause some of these companies to shift their product offerings in stores. We are seeing we never like to see certain companies cutting back on cards, but we're actually seeing gains in some areas. And we're seeing both card companies and some retailers becoming, I think, smarter and more nimble in choosing new lines that they've never carried in their stores before, or portions of lines from varied companies to give them more of a personalized mix that their customers are looking for right now.
Now, this is the age of the internet, and it might seem on the face of it like, okay, people might turn away from greeting cards and go with, e-vites or email thank yous or social media to send pictures. Are you seeing that cutting into greeting cards at all?
Yeah, that's interesting. You would think that people would be shifting from a paper-based product to something that's electronic and just sticking with it. But you mentioned millennials. Actually, we see millennials going the other way in that they've grown up with electronic communications, and frankly, they're not so enthused by it anymore, and in many cases, they're looking for something that's longer lasting and really gives them a personalized touch, both for themselves and for recipients. So millennials are I suppose, going the opposite direction, in they're looking for something that they can hold in their hand, they can physically hand over to a loved one or a friend, and let those folks know that they really, you know, they really care about them, and they took a minute or two out of their daily life to really think about that person. And that doesn't happen very often nowadays. So it's nice to see that. And it's not just happening with millennials. There are folks who are using digital cards and e-cards. Many of the larger companies produce them. You also find companies online who only sell their cards online, but then they have a mix of electronic and hard copy paper cards. We actually see e-cards and electronic cards, and most of the companies feel this way, that e-cards and electronic communications and quick greetings are kind of an entry point to those who might want to find something that's a bit more personalized and really speaks to not only them, but the recipient. So in a lot of ways, we think that the e-card generation is looking for more at this point. And we're not seeing e-cards and similar products really cutting into sales for the most part.
Now, apart from birthdays and anniversaries, I would think some card sales are obviously going to be at a particular time of year, the Valentine's Day, the Mother's Day, Christmas, sure, holidays. How do you see greeting card sales dispersed out throughout the year?
Well, I would like to put a shout out to all those who purchase St. Patrick's Day cards personally. I think that holiday gets it gets too small a percentage of sales. So I want all my St. Patrick's Day lovers to get out there. But Christmas is and has been for many years the top seller when it comes to numbers. And then Valentine's Day is close behind. Mother's Day is a huge holiday for greeting card companies, and I'm happy to say that we've seen a jump recently in Father's Day cards as well. So I'm looking forward to receiving something short.
Talking to Peter Doherty with the Greeting Card Association, we're talking about the past, present, and future of greeting cards. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still like to send cards? Have you recently gotten more into sending actual physical greeting cards? Or have you fizzled, turned to some form of electronic communication? Do you like getting a greeting card in the mail? Does it break up the monotony of the bills and advertisements? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And Peter, I understand that, and you were talking about this a little bit, companies are trying to be smarter. There's more premium cards. There's just maybe more variety and coolness about the cards that people might find these days.
Oh, absolutely. The Greeting Card Association estimates that roughly 6 billion cards are purchased each year. And it's safe to say that there are a larger percentage of premium cards now, cards in a certain price range above $5, $6, $7. And some of that points to the innovation coming from larger and smaller companies. Most of the companies who are members of our organization, as a matter of fact, are companies who have only been in the industry for the past 3 to 5 years, and they generally make their cards available online or through perhaps 2, 3, 4, 5 dozen card and stationery companies around the in their general area. We're seeing lots of innovation from those smaller companies and some of the larger companies, Hallmark, American Greetings, Designer Greetings, you can name all of them. They are learning, I think, from some of the trials and testing that are being done by smaller companies. You're seeing investors getting involved in some cases in companies that have come out with new products recently. Pop-up cards, musical cards, video cards, cards that are being produced not just with paper, but premium paper or even different types of surfaces. I've seen wooden cards. I've seen cards made entirely of bronze or copper or even stainless steel. How would it feel to get something like that in the mail? The postage is probably fairly high in that case, but it's a fantastic thing to receive and certainly memorable. But there are still cards in the 99-cent price point and below. So there is something out there for everybody.
Let's bring in our callers now. Abby starts us off in Brookfield. Abby, hi.
Hi. Yeah, so I just wanted to say I'm 18 years old, which I know is not typically the card demographic, but I love greeting cards, and I always send thank you cards because my mom has always taught me that that's really important, that, you know, that personal touch shows that you really are grateful. So it's something that I'm doing now that I'll continue to do, I'm sure, for a really long time.
And Abby, in your circle of friends in that 18-ish year demographic, do they think, oh, that's cool, oh, that's weird, oh, I'm going to do it too? What kind of reactions do you get?
I'd say most of the time my thank you cards go to my family, but with my friends, we all send each other like notes or letters a lot, especially just to like show that we're thankful, or, you know, if somebody's having a rough time, to kind of console somebody. So that's something that we really like to keep up too.
Abby, thanks a lot for that call. So that's even a post-millennial there, Peter. She sends cards to family and it sounds like written notes to friends as well. So it's not all online.
Yeah, that's excellent to hear. We have a lot of information on millennials, but we're also seeing post millennials getting involved in card sending and trying to keep those important connections. It's so hard to lose them. Baby boomers. Now, I don't know if her parents are Generation X, that's my generation, or baby boomers, but either way, baby boomers have always been champions of cards, and they continue to be. And Generation X has stuck with it, but we're seeing purchases from millennials actually passing baby boomers now as the largest single generation purchasing cards in terms of dollar amount, and that's pretty exciting. And it's also interesting to note that many of the card companies getting started now are owned by millennials. And those just getting started. So they're taking something that they love and they're finding ways to monetize it, and good for them.
We're talking about greeting cards and who's buying them these days with Peter Dougherty, Executive Director of the Greeting Card Association. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still like to buy paper greeting cards and send them to friends, family, or do you send those sentiments via text or e-card? What would you rather get, a card or an email? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. If you send us a card, we probably won't be able to talk about it on the air in time. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the changing market for greeting cards and how the greeting card industry is adapting. Peter Dougherty is our guest, Executive Director of the Greeting Card Association. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you sending fewer greeting cards than you used to, or more? How do you feel when you get one in the mail versus something in your inbox? Is there a memorable greeting card you've given or received? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I do something a little bit more subversive. I make my own cards.
Uh-huh. And what do you make them out of, Tom?
I just find available paper. Sometimes it's typing paper if I've got some heavier grades of paper. I usually have a set of colored magic markers, some Elmer's glue and glitter, and whatever else I think I want to affix to the card. I used to go to shop for cards, and I would always want the exact thing for the person, you know, something that really fits. And I'd find myself going to one, two, or three different places that sell cards. And I realized I was spending so much time going through the cards, I thought, I'm going to save more time just by making my own.
Fantastic, Tom. I love it. Thanks a lot for calling in. And Peter, you were saying earlier, there are probably a lot of people who started like Tom and now are actually selling their creations.
Oh, absolutely. It's fantastic to hear Tom doing that. We've seen a real groundswell for homemade cards and craft cards, and you see them all over the place at local fairs and exhibits. And we've actually considered putting together an awards program for the craft card portion of the industry. We have an annual event called the Louis Awards, which celebrates the best greeting cards of the year. A lot of folks will start making their own cards and they'll see something that really appeals to them and they start sharing it with their friends. And their friends say, well, you should do something about this. You should, there could really be a market for this. And that's how a lot of the companies get their start. One nice thing about the greeting card business is it's relatively inexpensive to start a company. Now, doing everything the right way, well, that's something else entirely, but there are tools out there to help people get their start. But it's an inexpensive hobby to pick up, and it could really lead to something.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We'll go now to Elizabeth on the line in Madison. Elizabeth, hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes, what did you want to say about greeting cards, Elizabeth?
Yes, I love to give greeting cards and include a little note in them, and I love receiving them and displaying them. It just makes me so happy. And my favorite cards are from Trader Joe's.
And Elizabeth, do you just send them on for special occasions or do you just send them out of the blue to people?
Usually anniversaries, birthdays, just to keep in touch with people in a good old-fashioned way.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for the call. And she mentioned, Peter, she loves to display them. That's something that's a little harder to pull off with an email.
That's for sure. Actually, a lot of folks either stick with greeting cards or they return to greeting cards because they've been a little frustrated by electronic messaging in the past. There's actually a card company that's a member of GCA called Auto Incorrect. And I know the owner of this company, and their specialty is text-based cards that celebrate all of the things that happen, unfortunately, to your messages when you're about to send them to a friend or loved one or even a colleague. You can get some pretty funny alternate messages that you did not intend. Let's just say that. The cards that are available out there in the in stores from the smallest gift store in your local area to the larger stores like Walmart or CVS or Target, it's great to see all the variety, all the innovation, all the fresh faces sharing their craft.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the past, present, and future of the greeting card. Peter Doherty is with us from the Greeting Card Association. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to send and or receive physical greeting cards? Back to your calls now. We've got Vivian calling from Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. Greeting cards. I always save what I can from the covers or whatever, cut them off, save them for a few months, and then donate those pieces of greeting cards to the local library. And they have a second life as bookmarks.
Oh, what a good idea.
And in the 1970s, 76, I coached a girls' soccer team when it was in its infancy here in Green Bay. And I sent the kids, because these kids ranged from 8 to 10, and I sent postcards after each game, just a little personal note, and you can make a really cute character out of a soccer ball. I'm a baby boomer. My friends and I still send cards, and some of them are so gorgeous. My source for a lot of unique cards is a thrift store. I find vintage greeting cards there, and sometimes they're so cute, I don't send them. But anyway, it's a fun place to look for cards that someone else has decided not to use. And you don't find a second card like that anywhere.
Vivian, thanks so much. Ahead of the curve, coaching a soccer team in the 70s. Thanks for that call. She mentioned, it sounds like she kind of collects some of those. Is that a thing, Peter? People collecting greeting cards?
Oh, it absolutely is a thing. We have a section on our website, and there is a museum that shares the earliest greeting cards, including those that were originally produced for the first time in England. Greeting cards became a thing here in the United States around the 1880s, and since then, it's become a real collector's item and a keepsake for a lot of folks. I'm lucky because I'm just down the road from the National Postal Museum, run by the United States Postal Service, and they have a quite varied collection of greeting cards, first issues, and just seeing those pristine cards. And, you know, I talk about all the variety that you see in cards that are available for purchase today, but it was a different kind of look and feel back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. You don't see those cards anymore. And I really appreciate those who are collecting cards. And we actually will take collections of cards from folks to try to preserve as much history as we can. So do a lot of the other card companies. It's a piece of our history we need to hold on to for sure.
Time for another caller or two. Sarah is with us in Menominee. Sarah, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Sarah?
Well, I've been sending greeting cards across the country and to two different countries for about 5 years now, and I have about 65 to 70 pen pals.
Wow.
That I write. I started doing it to help fight my depression, and I always thought it was very depressing to get bills all the time, so I decided that I'd spend time when I was upset to write happy thoughts and, like, positive statements and send them to all my friends and family and whoever I had addresses for, and it just went crazy.
What a great story, Sarah. Thanks so much. So greeting cards is therapy, Peter, in our last few moments.
Oh, it absolutely is. And it's you know, it's just as much the person that you're getting the card from as the card itself, but it's just a way to convey that special message. And I collect them myself. Of course, it's a little easier for me because I'm surrounded by cards all the time. And I get a lot of variety coming through the doors, but it's great, and it reminds you of, you know, a wonderful moment in your life, and it's easy to hold on to, and they're compact, so it's easy to collect cards. Why not?
We'll leave it there, Peter. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
That's Peter Doherty, Executive Director of the Greeting Card Association. We talked with him about the changing nature of the greeting card industry. If you still want to tell us about your greeting card habits, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, another high-profile cabinet post opened up this week, leaving a large number of acting appointees in the Trump White House. We'll find out more in our weekly roundup of national news. A new WisContext report takes an up-close look at the Wisconsin zip code with one of the highest crime and incarceration rates in the state. We'll find out what they learned. And we'll look at the rise of TV talent shows from American Idol to Dancing with the Stars and find out why they took over the small screen. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the annual State of the Tribes Address, which was delivered today at the state capitol. We'll look at some of the issues that came up there from the environment to education. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.